Hi, everyone. It's Casey Trufo, and I'm here with Dr. Ofer Zur, the architect, founder of the ZurInstitute.com. I think there's probably not a therapist on the planet that doesn't know about the Zur Institute. It's a place where you can get literally hundreds of CEU programs. I know I'm up for renewal in about 2 weeks, so I'm going to be visiting your site to make sure that I get enough of my CEUs. They're wonderfully done, and I just want to welcome you, Ofer.
Thank you, thank you. Nice to be with you again on completely different topic and another cutting-edge topic, so that's nice. You're kind of keeping us really at the edge of our seats with new ideas and new challenges.
Well, you were the one that brought this to me, and I just think it is so important, and that is the title of this session, is Helping Children and Parents Deal with Internet and Online Gaming Use, Abuse, and Addictions. So share with us your whole thoughts about the digital natives and the digital immigrants. I just find that fascinating.
You know, I think that kind of we as therapists, as parents, and as educators are encountering something that kind of a little bit unprecedented with the way we have been trained or used to function. We have a new tribe of what we call digital immigrants who are at our midst. They are in our school, they are in our homes, they are in our therapy sessions. And we kind of lack the skills, the knowledge, the compassion, the understanding of how this subculture operates. And as a result, we get worried, we get concerned, we feel shut out, and we yell, oh, you're addicted, oh, you're ADHD, you are going down the drain into destruction, even though they are preparing themselves perfectly to their future, not to our future. So we see distressing parents who are concerned about kids wasting their time on the computer, distressed teachers where the kids do not read, and distressed therapists where the natives come to their offices and they are texting and sometimes watching short videos in the middle of sessions and or checking our Facebook profile and want to be our friends, and we are just at loss and create a lot of tension and a lot of unhappiness that so much of it comes from just sheer ignorance. So I see my job kind of as bridging between cultures with your help today, Casey.
Well, tell your story about your daughter.
I'm not sure which one. I have three digital natives at the midst, and I left right now the house, and my 15-year-old was sitting on a computer, and he was definitely checking his Facebook right after school. The NBA, he's preparing to play, so the television is on. He's doing homework. He's reading the text in order to do the homework, and a trailer is actually playing on the right-hand side, and his iTunes is on. And I'm looking at this kid, and I say, how does he function? I get overwhelmed looking at him, say the least, just counting the things that he's supposed to multitask. He doesn't multitask. There's another kind of misunderstanding that we have. But does he really read? Does he do his homework? Is he ADHD? I mean, and what does it do? How does it do that? You know, you sometimes put makeup in the cars when you drive, Casey. This is the most complex multitasking that you probably
and
do.
And I can't do that. Literally.
You can't even do that.
No.
Okay. And I can talk on the phone while I drive. And actually, I'm very focused, and this is kind of a good multitasking that I can do. And so how do we view the kids' relationship to reading? And indeed, they don't read the way we would have hoped they read. How do we deal with the multitasking? Where are they going? How are they going to be ready to the world? And this is kind of the question that we would like to address today. I've been guided with this journey with my daughter, who is 27. She's UC Berkeley philosophy major, so she's very good in anthropology and asking the hard questions. And so I have a watch, kind of a watch girl above me that would make sure that she calls me on. You know, yesterday we had a conference with other presenters, and an authoritative older man, I don't know even his name, announced that technology depresses us and technology causes all this harm. And it was just such a perfect immigrant statement that kind of was so ignorant. Do we have studies that technology depress us? Yeah, sure. Do we have studies that technology dumb us down? No, we don't. And but immigrants, we give it such a bad name. And as therapists, we are a little bit worse in all this because we think we know. At least parents sometimes get overwhelmed and don't know. With therapy, we have an illusion that we know, but we really don't understand this drive. And today we'll try to do kind of an intro into this drive.
So where do we start?
Where do we start? Let's kind of start perhaps with the difference between the two generations, between the digital immigrants and digital natives. So kind of that could be introduction to this drive. And where is the line between the two generations? There's no really clear line in the sand. The kids who kind of grew up with VCRs and computers, all the digital natives, they are usually 40, 45 and less. So anybody above 45, above 50 is definitely with a digital immigrant. And it doesn't mean that we don't like computers. That just means that it's a language and culture that we to. Some of us are more adaptive than others, and some of us are reluctant adapters, and some of them are non-adapters. So it's not that all digital immigrants are clueless technologically wise, except that we just haven't grown up with that. It's not in our DNA. It's not in our brain didn't need to adjust to that at age 3 months old.
And, one of the definitions of technology that I've heard is technology is what's come after you were born.
Yeah.
Because a microwave to my 90-year-old mother-in-law is technology. But to my stepdaughter, what do you mean? There was a time before microwaves?
Yeah, that's ancient. So this computer technologies.
Oprah, yes. Let me interrupt you a little bit. You're breaking up a little bit. I don't know if you can move around somewhere.
I'm not sure I'm on a landline, if you believe it or not.
Yeah, and it's not an internet phone, right?
It's not no, it's actually not an internet phone.
Okay, that sounds better. And, sometimes I just move it a little bit, and it seems to work a little better.
Okay, you tell me if I, and I'm not sure what did I do, but I just put the plug a little bit.
Okay, that sounds much better.
Oh, good. So what the digital, the older one, we prefer to talk on the phone or talk in person. The young ones prefer to do it via chat or kind of Facebook or via games. That means if I want to connect with my kids, all three of them, I can call from now to until the cows come home, and or I can just text them and they'll respond to me within seconds, including in the middle of school. And I'll text my son in the middle of school. He'll look at the phone, put it back in his pocket, and text to me in his pocket without looking. Dad, what do you think? I'm in school. Don't text me now. But he can do it in the middle of an exam.
Wow.
It takes him 5 seconds, and he can do it without even looking. So that's how we kind of text sparingly, and they kind of text with their eyes closed all the time. We prefer synchronistic communication. That means face-to-face at the same time, the same way that right now we are in this teleconference. And they often prefer an asynchronistic or what we call sequential communication that they get in Facebook or they get in texting or we get in email. It can be very fast, but it nevertheless, it's sequential. one of the major differences or conceptual difference that we have with them is that we like manuals. We like to, I wanted to know how to put PowerPoint today, how to create a fly-in, and I asked my techie how to do it. And I asked him, please give me 1, 2, 3, 4. It was so hard for him. Because he said, I know how to do it, but he couldn't explain to me how to do it because for him, he click, click, click. The same is all my three kids. If I ask them a question, can you tell me 1, 2, 3, 4, they look at me as if I'm an alien, and I am. So they work intuitively, and they figure out by clicking very fast, by trial and error. They don't think about it as trial and error, but we can think about it as immigrants, a trial and error, very fast, and this is how they figure out. This is how 2 years old can figure out the VCR remote. It's not because they go to the manuals. They don't have a system of linear and hierarchical, but it's in what we call intuitive. Most software, most computers are geared towards this population. This is why it's so hard for us sometimes to figure it out. Because we like manuals, and they just do it intuitively. When you and I do things intuitively, Casey, we can figure it out, but when I at least won't remember how did I get there and I have to start from scratch. The natives have a learning curve through intuitive learning. So even when the immigrants learn intuitively, sometimes it doesn't help us. We need to start from scratch next time. We speak proper English, and they got to go, G2G, laughing out loud, whatever it is that they need to do. So they use a lot of kind of instant messaging type of shortcuts, and definitely part of the gaming and part of the communication. We tell our friends about the latest trip by phone or in person or in a slide presentation online, and they'll just do it through an album online to all their friends in Facebook.
Found out one of my staff members was pregnant because it came in on her Facebook profile.
You know, I have a friend who found out that one of the best friends died. And this is somebody not from the childhood. This is somebody that they've been in contact on a weekly basis. And they found out on Facebook that the friend died.
Wow.
And so we get all outrage about it as immigrants. But for them, it's most effective. And you cannot argue that it's ineffective because it's a highly effective way to communicate with hundreds or thousands of people. We use the internet to gather information primarily, watch the news and stuff like that. They use it to socialize, to play, to watch videos, to create videos. We think that they waste their time online, but actually they are happily connected and happily learning. Some of the biggest games that they play, the World of Warcraft, it's a highly learning type of game. They learn how to work together, they learn how to raid, they learn how to accumulate stuff, they have highly creative avatars that they create. So we think it's a waste of time, but in fact it is creative, and some of it is highly waste of time as well, but it's not always. We think about one task of pleasure at a time, and they, like describe my boys, they'll do it 7 at a time. We find it very hard to deal with 7 tasks at a time because we are lousy in multitasking and we are worse at hopping. So their brains don't really multitask necessarily. They hop from one task to the other really, really fast. We have a sense of concern with privacy, with kidnapping, with assault and robberies. And the main concern is issues of sexting, inappropriate picture. The sense of privacy is very different. So we see a truly people who see the world and see themselves in relationship to the world very different than we are. And as therapists, as parents, as an educator, the first step for us is for us to understand this tribe who operates so different than we are.
And that's not only, yes, because when they're in our office, that's a little bit harder to see. I mean, like you have an example here of during a counseling session, the teenager will answer her phone.
They will answer the phone and depends what kind of immigrant or digital natives we are as therapists. If it's a native therapist, probably they will not blink. They'll be kind of seem very normal. And usually they'll text back or answer very fast. They won't think twice about it. But many, I was in a presentation in Virginia, and one woman, older woman, stood up in the back of the room, and she said she looked at it as resistance. Yeah, sure, you should talk to this 12-year-old to just answer the text, start doing resistance analysis from a psychodynamic point of view. Yeah, sure, this will get you very far. I saw somebody yesterday, and so he was he got a text and he got a video, and he said, "Would you like to see the video?" I said, "I better want to see the video." So I moved from my chair, got sat next to him, and saw the video that his friend sent him. He took his iPad out and he showed me the video that he created that morning, and suddenly I was in his world, downloading the video, joining him, and really understanding the aspiration of this young man. And we talk about what's the challenges, what does he want to do with that, where does he go career-wise. But I flew with his digital nativeness rather than look at that as rude.
I love it.
And because I didn't think he was rude, and he sure wasn't. He just was in his world. It's not much different when I went to the Somali desert, and 6 out of 7 kids will die before age 2. We can say they don't love the kids, they bury them without tears, but this is the rule of the desert. The desert cannot sustain 7 kids.
Yeah.
So how do we really shift our worldview? And therapists present a paradox. We're so proud of ourselves of individual differences. We're so proud of ourselves of being getting into the worldview of our clients, but in fact we are really lousy at that, and we come up with a lot of judgment, and one of the big ones is the internet addiction, and this is kind of one of our subtopic.
Yeah, you want to go there?
No, not yet. No,
okay.
No. We'll leave it to the very end, because it's really a very minor concern. My concern is with a digital immigrants not understanding. This is the biggest problem with the culture, not the addicted. Not to say there isn't addicted behaviors and they are not abuse that they have. I can throw my 2 cents on that. What we know about abuse right now, that most kids in the United States and in Europe at least, what they do is they discover a game, they take a dive into that, and spend sometimes up to 18 hours a day. What happened to most young people, the correct, the kind of John Grohl model, so they go from use to overuse to abuse to correction to balance. Few of them will go from use to abuse to addiction. And so a lot of them are self-correct. They self-correct when they get the grades at school. They self-correct when they kick out of school. They self-correct when somebody tell them either you get offline or divorce you, or the parents go to the end of their rope. But most kids self-correct. When I talk to hundreds of young people, this is their experience. The experience that they kind of did overuse for a while, and then correct. But we can talk later on more about internet addiction. A word about multitasking and hopping, perhaps this would be something for us to know. When my kid does all these 7 activities that I describe, watching YouTube, reading, watching the NBA, watching a trailer, doing homework, and of course Facebook, in and out Facebook, he does not multitask. His brain quickly hops. He shut off the video in his mind, and he goes to Facebook. He responds to Facebook, and then he does a reading of 1 paragraph of the text online. And then he does the homework. He writes 2 sentences and go back to Facebook and then watch a bit of the NBA. So his brain really does not multitask. It's impossible to multitask within these tasks. What his brain does, that our brain of the immigrants cannot do, it hops very fast, and many argue very efficiently.
Can I say something about that?
Sure.
There's a book, I don't know if you've read, called The Myth of Multitasking, How Doing It All Gets Nothing Done by Dave Crenshaw. And it's really a book, it's one of those fable books where somebody goes in, a consultant goes in to help this lady manager out, and he shows her how much more efficient she is if she finishes one task before taking on another. I'm wondering if that, maybe there's some truth to that for those of us that are digital immigrants, that for us that switch, he says there's no multitasking, it's called switch tasking, because you really can't do multiple things at the same time. What you're saying is that the kids are doing this switch tasking very fast, and for them it's normal, it's easy, it's intuitive, it's supportive to who they are in their growing and learning. But perhaps, is it possible for those of us that are digital immigrants that it wouldn't work for us, that we really do need to slow down?
You know, what he talks about the dumbing down generation. You know, what he kind of threw a tantrum about technology. That's what he does. But as we know, the train left the station.
Yes.
We can scream and yell as much as we want, but this is how the kids are not reading books right now. They're reading paragraphs at best.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right that we are not effective in hopping.
That's what I'm saying. We are not effective at that, right?
But the young ones are effective, and they are going to go around the world differently. He says that they are dumbed down in the criteria, that they don't know how to balance a checkbook.
Oh,
but
I see.
They don't need to learn to balance a checkbook anymore. The checkbook are balanced online. Nobody need to balance the checkbook. If they even verify the expenses or not, it's being balanced perfectly online 24/7 every millisecond. So if we try to, we say they don't read books, and this is a criteria for somebody to be dumbed down. The answer for that is dual. First of all, they don't read books from beginning to the end. They scan a lot of the books, and mostly they read one paragraph at a time. Is that dumbed down with the criteria of us immigrants? Probably. But this is not the world that they are going to grow into that. There won't be checkbooks in Europe in 2017. It'll be, I'm not sure it'll be legal, but it won't be available. It'll be all online. And the young ones will know how to operate right there. So when we say you're so dumb you cannot balance your checkbook, it's dumb to say in some regard. The same thing around reading. You know, we can talk about what is our wedness to reading. And again, I'm challenging everything that we thought intuitively is correct. We all went to school and we got your MA, and then we survived the MFT exam and the psych exam and social worker exam, and now we're going to have LPC in California, and we had to do tons of reading for that. So, and we all read Tolstoy and other classics when we grew up, and we pride ourselves on reading the best 50 classics. You know, they are not going to go through that. What's the value of that? It's really nice for us immigrants and give us a good sense of being cultured and stuff, but reading is something new that just started in the 13th, 14th century with the press. Before that was the oral tradition. The educated people heard a lot of stories from the elderly of the tribes and from the wise women and from other people who were functioning as leaders and teachers within the tribal cultures or whatever they were before the 12th century. So now we have, for the last 700 years, we have the press, and everybody thinks the criteria for intelligence is reading. And these kids are going through a different mode of being. It's not the oral history of the early years of humanity. It's not the short period of the print and the written word. It's now images and graphics. So we are moving to a different world. They're going to see the world via the images that, of course, they see through the Internet. So if we use a digital immigrant criteria, they come out pretty dumb. But that's pretty dumb of us to do. Because
yeah,
that's not the world they are growing up to.
Well, there was a time when if you didn't know Latin, You are not very cultured.
Yeah, and who would have heard about that, you know?
Yeah.
There was times that you, in order to get a PhD, you need to speak two other languages.
Mm.
And one of them would be Latin, you know? And I come from a European culture that this was a value. And who would have heard about that right now? So they are moving to a way of processing and communicating and seeing the world, which are image and graphic based, and it's not a written word of the last 700 years, and it's not the oral tradition where human beings spend most of their evolutionary time was around that one. So whenever we say, oh my goodness, they don't read, that's kind of a value judgment of immigrant that we need just to say, what's the value in that? It's just what we don't.
Yeah, that's a hard one, because there wasn't the video back when my parents were young, so reading was incredibly important. And then at the same time, we're looking at our children and our grandchildren and say, oh, they're looking at YouTube videos? That's just waste of time, where indeed that's where some of the most important learning, I think, if some of our schools, you know, I live in Southern California where we have some of the worst.
Actually, the most important learning will be in gaming.
Yeah, I agree with you.
That's and the train has left the station on that. And he also have a whole thing about gaming and how dumbed down it is. And you know, some of the first shooter games are pretty dumbed down, I have no doubt. They're really kind of killing time.
Remember Pac-Man?
And Pac-Man involves some skills, actually, that not very sophisticated. Most of the games right now are highly interactive. So, again, perhaps you can open it to a little bit more discussion after that. So if we sit here 20 years from now, most of the school will be teaching kids through gaming. The kids will not fall asleep. They're going to connect to the game and go to 11th century Europe and make an avatar and live within this culture and learn about the music and the food and the culture and the history and how they learn and how they interact and how they did war. And it will be some conflict be involved, and the kids will have to get together within the tribal system and to win over another tribe. So there will be some tension. So the game will draw them. They'll be able to collect some gold. So it will be kind of what War of Warcraft is about. And they'll do it with 40, 60 kids around the world, from all over the world, getting together and ready to do raids, to learn how to work together. And the question that's really the more important question, not whether it's dumbed them down, all these activities from YouTube as well as to gaming, is, by the way, tomorrow I'm going to Sacramento to make 7 YouTube short movies about boundaries. I'll do about gifts and about touch and about digital ethics and about dual relationship, and I'm going to put it on YouTube, just because, as you said, this is a lot of where the learning is. Mm-hmm. The question is, where the balance is. Do they go and play ball? Do they also have physical activities offline? Do they have a balance of connecting with people online versus offline? Do they have an experience of nature not via the internet? The issue of balance of online, offline, with friends, without friends, virtual versus non-virtual, and we need to watch out, we don't call it virtual versus real, because this is real for them. The issue of balance is a more important question rather than the issue, are they being dumbed down or not, because they are not. They are being educated to the world they have to live in.
Yeah, I mentioned this on the preview call. For those of you, if you want to check out TED, TED Talks, Jane McGonigal, she does a great one on gaming and how really the future of our world problems can be solved when we bring the world together in a game-like way. And she was saying something like, hey, you know, solve this problem, 10 points. And it's very funny in the video, Ofer, because she says, the worst thing about giving this presentation is I'm not going to get a +1 at the end of it.
Yeah. It's so I'm kind of, as you mentioned it, I just Google it, and I'm start watching it very quietly as I'm multitasking.
You know, the judgment part, I think, was a really important point that you brought up between, and I think of it more of adults and children, but I do think that there is this big spectrum, you know, big, long kind of thing where on that one hand we have, you know, very solid digital immigrants, and on the other we have, you know, baby natives, and there is some kind of, we're all on that scale somewhere in between. But I know when I go to get my nails done, it's in this nice, quiet little spa salon, and when the young people come in and they're talking loudly on their cell phones, they're thinking nothing of it, and I'm thinking how rude it is. I mean, that is my judgment. And if my phone rings and I have to take it, I apologize to my nail lady.
But they have a different sense of space and time. And in my presentation, I show some of the videos that these kids put on YouTube. And there's just no sense of privacy. I mean, I tell my kids, whatever you put online, you have to treat it as if it's tattooed on your forehead. It will be there forever, and your college counselor will see it, your future mate will see it, your future employer will see it. So,
and do they get that?
They don't. Yeah. But, you know, we didn't get a lot of things when I'm not sure about you. You probably were a perfect little girl, Casey, but I sure wasn't.
No.
I had to learn the hard way again and again and again. And so some of them getting it better than others, and many of them don't too often. Some questions, wonders, ponders.
Yeah, if you're on the phone and you want to press *2 and you want to give an opinion or ask a question, go ahead. We do have a question on the webcast here about sexting. We have two questions. Actually, one person says, what is that? I've never heard of that. Another person says, you know, where do we draw the line with our kids?
Okay, so the first, the one who hasn't heard about it is an immigrant, we can say.
Yeah.
And sure. And sexting is when it's most commonly a girl sending a picture of herself to her boyfriend, whom she loves, and she'll always love him, even though she's 14 and 15, and he's the love of her life, and then the breakup, or she's kind of give a kiss to another boy, and he's getting pissy about it, or even without being pissy, he's just broke up, and he's sending her naked pictures to all his buddies, who's sending to everybody else. What I found out from my 15 years old, actually, that it's not only girls' naked pictures floating around. And it's actually boys as well. So boys' private parts are floating around in sexting right now. And this is another force of the Internet. It becomes kind of equal opportunity. How do we deal with the kids? Perhaps I'll answer a bigger question. What about pornography and stuff like that? Because there are a lot of kind of dark forces. Sites of how to commit suicide and sites how to detonate a bomb, and of course the porn is what drives so much of the Internet development. It's a porn academia and the military that developed the Internet in some regard. Definitely the porn people developed the cam technology and the buying online before eBay and Google, before
right.
eBay and Amazon. So I have, for my 15 years old, I have a parental control and on a Mac for the PC to be NannyNet. My 17, almost 18 years old, many years ago already learned how to go around it. And at his age, I'm not interested in controlling. I'm interested in him internalizing the control. So it's a lot of conversation about pornography and violence. And we have good relationship, and we're preparing for college. So we go around traveling to different states to look at colleges, and fantastic conversation on the plane. And as we hike, he's a kid I climb Kilimanjaro with, so we know how to walk and talk and for days, weeks at a time. So we need to protect them. So I'm a friend of my 15 years old on Facebook, and my daughter is a friend of my 27 years old. So we kind of have checks and balances about what's happening with them. But we don't need to, as they grow older, we don't need to have hands off. And my daughter is so good with her privacy setting that I see only what she chose to show me, thank God. Fine with me. I thank her.
Exactly. Well, I have a question here about... I'm sorry, go ahead.
So sexting is something kind of one of the dark side of the internet that we just need to continue to educate them about. So it goes with the right age. When do we teach them about sex? How do we teach them about sex? When do we talk to them about condom and birth control? And we talked about sexting. So it's kind of part of the conversation. For this, the digital immigrants need to know what they're talking about so they can have the conversation.
I guess my worry is just the legal stuff. My understanding, and I'm not an attorney, obviously, but some of that sending of those sex pictures to the love of your life can end up with some legal consequences, such as child pornography.
You know, it's really one of those cutting edge right now, a question about do you prosecute the 13-year-old who have a naked picture and they disseminate it online or via the phone. You know, we are so archaic. The way we do therapy is archaic. Our laws are archaic. Our educational system are archaic. So their train left the station of technology, or our train, but the laws and the education and the parenting and so many other things are so archaic and irrelevant. And intelligent people struggling with that, or intelligent people like you inviting some education in this topic, and some attorneys and legislators understand it to be completely crazy to arrest a 13-year-old and to make him kind of a sex offender, because that's what he has on his phone, a child pornography. But then we have a lot of rigidity. The good news is that us digital immigrants will die.
Yes.
And the legislators will be digital natives.
Yeah, but I predict they'll have some problem with their kids.
They'll have different kind of troubles with their kids. But I don't think it will be the same jump that we have with our kids.
You think this is a big jump?
I think it's a big jump. The technology, it's really changed our lives differently. You know, we rebelled against our parents, and we went to Woodstock, and we loved the Beatles, whatever, you know.
Right.
Really radical. But you know, and there was television that they didn't grow up, and phones that they didn't grow up with. And it did some changes. But I think this changing in a much more essential way the relationship to the world and the relationship to each other much more, that it's a bigger leap that television and phones did, even though it was a big leap compared to where our parents did.
Well, and the way they're learning, the way that they process information is just different.
Absolutely, and this is where the intuitive part that I described before, as well as the gaming. But we call them ADHD, even though they sit 18 hours a day and playing a game. What kind of ADHD is that? We just give it a name-calling just because we don't know what it is, and we feel shut out. And the more we yell at them that they are not attending to us, the more they want to go and play the games away from us. And sometimes we don't know what kind of a game. Say, you can play for 2 hours, you know? Some games you cannot play for 2 hours. You need to have four minimum, two, three times a week. So some kids will need to have 4 times, 3 days a week, rather than 2 hours every day. We need to know what they're doing. I got a temporary account of World of Warcraft, and my boy and I went online and played together. He thought I'm so dumb and slow and incompetent, and it was wonderful the way he could establish expertise, you know?
Yeah.
And it
wasn't
fantastic
about basketball and being able to do better hoops than you, or running where you could outrun him.
I mean, I can't do either, by the way, so don't rub it in, Casey. But it's like it gave him fantastic sense of mastery, and we learned together. And now I know about World of Warcraft firsthand. And also I had an experience with my son laughing together.
That was great. That was great. Okay, so where should we go next with this discussion?
Are there any questions? So,
those were the two that I had so far. If you have any other questions, if you want to press *2 if you're on the phone, or if you want to put it in that little Q&A box. Oh, there is one coming in here right now. It says, but what do I do in session when the family is there worried about the child because they're texting? Let me see if I got this. A 15-year-old is texting with an 18-year-old boy.
16 and 18?
15 and 18.
You know, I mean, I think they should feel safer that if they were really driving in his car somewhere.
Oh, good point. Drinking. I was in the car with with the boy when they were drinking.
Yeah, yeah.
My parents didn't know about that.
I don't want to ask you what you did at 15, Casey, with 18 years old. But it seems to me it was much more dangerous than texting. So it was drinking
probably
and driving.
So. I think, yeah, driving and alcohol and texting and driving are maybe similar kinds of things that teens were doing in different generations.
Yeah, so in some regards, the parents may want to say, God, this is a little bit safer.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, there's a lot to teach them about the Internet and predatory behavior. Do they know the person? Because there is so much anonymous interaction online that they are used to. They don't know who they are talking to. And that gives a lot of freedom on the one hand, but it's also dangerous with that. Because we hear the kind of the rare stories where some girls met somebody that they met online and it didn't end up really well. So this requires us an information. Who is this 18 years old? How do you know that he is who he is? Because there's no way to know it online and there's no way to know it through the texting or sexting, whatever that they do. So it's a lot of conversation. But it's a conversation asking them to explain to us what they do and how they do it and help them think about it rather than try to control it, because we can't, because we don't know even the technology. So I'm inviting parents and therapists to dialogue with their kids about this issue. Who is this guy? And how do you know him? Do you plan on meeting him? And in some regard, as we say, it's kind of it is more safe in one way because they cannot get pregnant via texting.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you don't know who it is, and you don't know who her parents are, perhaps as it used to be in the old neighborhood. So it's a whole new complexity for difficult and less difficult that we need to embrace through knowing, getting on the floor. I remember when my kids were 2-3 months old, I went on the floor to see what the world looked like from when your head is 1 inch above the ground. Mm-hmm. And I saw the ugly gums under the chairs and the dust under the lower shelf. And I said, goodness. So, but it was a different perspective. So we need to get on the floor and to join them in order to be able to parent them well, rather than do the yelling, you are addicted and blah, 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 and throw tantrums, which throws them even more into technology. It's a challenge for us.
There's another question that came in here. It says, do you think it's our fear and not and our ability or that we don't understand that causes us to do that yelling?
Absolutely. This is kind of what perhaps is one thing from today that people will take with them. And, you know, I really encourage you, go to my website and find the article that I wrote with my daughter about digital native and digital immigrant. And we have a PowerPoint, we have resources, information about gaming and education. We have a great chart about how different the native from the immigrants. I gave you a handout, Casey, that you can put out. And we have, of course, 4 online courses, 3 by Kimberly Young on the topic of Internet addiction and 1 with my daughter and I on the digital divide, what we call. So what this caller or this person wrote is right on. We don't know, and we end up yelling, which creates more alienation and makes them want to play even more games or watch more YouTubes away from us. Just
and
to get
they
away
feel,
from us.
They feel so misunderstood.
Absolutely. And for
good reason.
They're right.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but in order for us therapists to help parents, we need to get on the floor. We need to know what they're talking about. And it shouldn't take much, really. I have a bunch of resources on that, and my daughter did a fantastic job, really, continued to correct me in my ignorance. And
yeah, I'm going to give that website name. It's Zur, Z as in zebra, U-R, institute.com. And if you, when you get there, you can look for that. You can go to the blog, and then on searching of the blog, just put in digital immigrant, and the blog entry will come up that you and your daughter wrote. I also want to guide you to the goodie bag, and in the goodie bag, Ofer has given a ton of stuff there for us. He's also given us a 10% discount on some of your online courses, so thank you for that quite a bit. Again, I'm going to be over there soon getting mine, so I really appreciate that. But go ahead and make sure you guys look in the goodie bag and see everything that he's got to offer.
And the other thing is kind of perhaps because it's a therapist conference, we can talk about what's relevant for us as therapists, not as, because the digital divide of native and immigrant also create a whole slew of complexities. We should do another teleconference on that, what I call digital ethics. It's just the hardest things in ethics and psychology right now. Are clients Googling us? How far do they go into Google? Do they do a simple Google or do they get intrusive Google? That means where they can find a whole bunch of information about us. Is it okay for us therapists to Google our clients? Under what circumstances is okay? Do we need to get informed consent? Of course, the hardcore immigrants, so no, it's unethical, you know? And then you talk to some other therapist. They talked to a woman yesterday who worked out of home, and she said, I Google everybody before they come to my home. I don't do the first interview outside the house. I do it on the phone. And I want to know if I have a rapist or a criminal coming to my office or whatever it is. And she Googles them to see what she can find before every person. And I help her put it into the informed consent, so there's a paragraph. So I have also articles about that, kind of whether it's okay to Google clients. One of the examples, New York Times and Boston Globe and LA Times came up with around Googling clients. So you have a client who is unconscious in the hospital, and you get the sense that there's a suicide attempt. Would you go online and find out perhaps what he or she took, ingested, so you can save their lives? Would you do that without consent? So a knee-jerk reaction for most digital immigrants is no, I'll never Google my clients without consent, or I'll never Google my clients, period. And then we get into more complex situations that I gave you just two examples that you see that people may consider doing it, and you can put it in informed consent that I will Google my client in time of crisis, or I do Google clients that I see in my home office.
Okay, well, since I'm sort of closer to in the middle on this continuum, tell me why it's unethical to Google your clients if what is out there is in public domain.
You know, this is kind of, I don't say it's unethical, but this is kind of the people who argue that will say you don't drive into the neighborhood where the clients live and take a binocular and watch what they do just because it's available to the public. So we are not private eyes. And so it's kind of getting us to different modes, searching them online, so I can see the point. Again, I don't say it's ethical or unethical, because what I want right now is not to know for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the junction. But the fact that it's public domain in the old non-digital world, the houses are on a street where it's public domain to drive, but we don't go and drive by the houses.
Well, you know, we had the Legal and Ethical Day pre-conference workshop, and I was talking with Steve Frankel about this, and he's both an attorney and a therapist. And he will say to his clients, you know, I understand that you might be interested and you might end up Googling me. And I understand that. That's natural curiosity. And I also want to tell you that I'm not intending it at all, no matter what you do or say in therapy in our room together, to abandon you. I will say that the quickest way to fire me as your therapist is to end up at my home should you ever find out where that is. So I think he was really setting a limit as to what he would take on the other side from somebody.
Yeah, but when they're intrusive.
Yeah.
At a certain point, we say no, but most clients Google us, and they should. This is how informed consumers finding a heart surgeon or cosmetic surgery or a dietitian. I mean, I want to know if my heart surgeon killed, you know, five people before me. And but this is a consumer-driven medical field. This is why people go to Yelp. And find out about us. I think it's the right thing to do. Do a lot of people complain? They go to the Google us in our board to see there is a website called complaint board that people check. So I think it's due diligence on their part. It's what Steve is probably referring correctly. If they go the further and try to get it to become our friend with pseudonames, or go into the listservs, which is very easy to do, or pay somebody to find information about us that can be highly intrusive and even criminal.
Yeah.
So, and we have the right to say, no, that's inappropriate, I'm not going to work with you, or this is illegal, whatever it is. But the basic Google, or kind of the more sophisticated Google, it's really appropriate for them before they come to see us for therapy. So the question of them Googling us, us Googling them. Then the question of Facebook, is it okay to have clients as friends in Facebook? And of course, all the rigid, uninformed digital immigrants will say no. And I'll say what I say depends. Depends what on your site, what kind of site you have. Many people start developing more Facebook sites that are 100% business type.
Right.
The way they
right.
do with Twitter. GM does it. Ford does it. Toyota does it. Now, the question is about issues of confidentiality. A latest article in the Bjorngren and Eric Harris talk about confidentiality in the National Psychologist, and I have it in my website as well, an article on that. So what happens if clients start kind of not only becoming friends, even if it's a professional site, but they start communicating in a non-confidential manner because it's not private, the website. They're not HIPAA compliant, blah, blah, blah. So do we use them only as fans rather than friends? So complicated. So the answer of no, 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 and no doesn't really hold. And as we are being thrown into this digital ethics question, some more digital question, digital ethics questions are email between clients and therapists. Do we do clinical work like that? Is it protective? Is it protected? Sites privacy-wise, confidentiality-wise. What about e-therapies that people do via email? Skype is not protected, but there are some sites who are indeed are protected. So with firewalls and other technologies that are, there's encryption email that some people are starting to use, even though it's not very consumer friendly yet.
Right.
So e-therapy. And the question of texting with clients. How do you keep records on texting with clients? I did a consultation with somebody, actually, who found out that she can print her text. She went to a techie guy that could print her text, which I thought was just fascinating. So now texting become part of the medical records. Yeah. How do you keep it? So, and our clients texting us without a blink.
Yeah.
So there are so many interesting digital cutting-edge questions in ethics, and we really need to make sure that we are not jumping into conclusion and knowing too fast right from wrong.
Yeah, one of the things that somebody told me early in my career was regarding a legal or ethical question. They said, don't ask a question you don't want the answer to. And I thought that was an interesting thing. And you said, I hope we don't find out too soon some of the answers to that. And I think you're right. Our associations, our laws are can never keep up with the speed at which technology is moving and the culture is changing. So it's a challenge for everyone.
It's a challenge, so we can have good methodologies of asking kind of what is the context of the therapy and who is the client, what's on the Facebook, who is the therapist, what is the nature of communication, what is the nature of the relationship, what is the setting, forensic setting could be very dangerous to do any of this stuff.
Right.
And so, again, Googling people, if you have a home office, have a different flavor versus Googling people in forensic setting. So I would like to introduce a thoughtful methodology with integrity rather than jumping to the don't, because we just finished with the don't go beyond, don't touch, and don't self-disclosure, and don't give gifts, and stuff like that. The field hopefully has evolved beyond that now. And but now we're kind of getting tight again on the new ethics, on the digital ethics, and I really hope that we'll stay open and we'll stay inquisitive.
Excellent. Well, we just have a few minutes left. Did you want to talk about the Internet and Gaming Addiction Assessment?
You know, the heart of Internet gaming addiction or any kind of Internet addiction is not much different than any other gaming. The question, does it interfere with major functions of your life, which has to do with health, if you are at school, with your education, with your relationships, if you are married or have a relationship. So the question is not so much of time and not so much of what you do, but does it interfere with other function? And we know that some kids have kind of addictive brain, or as we say, alcoholism can go in the family. Whatever it is that happens, some kids will get addictive. Some adults will get addictive, whether it's alcohol, methamphetamine, marijuana, gambling, pornography. And so there are some people that are truly addictive, and there are NetAddiction.com, Kimberly Young, has probably the most comprehensive and the most helpful site with self-assessment about addiction. So you can kind of get your own score and see kind of where you are, or you could do your child, or you could do your spouse, kind of. And the treatment for that is definitely has to be abstinence-based rather than harm reduction-based rather than abstinence-based, because the world, in order to function effectively in the world, people have to have access to computer. So we don't want to use the abstinence base of the 12-step program and almost all rehab programs that might may be appropriate for alcohol and cocaine and heroin and this kind of substances, or pornography even. With the internet addiction, we needed to move it to a harm reduction where people use it in a way that is not destructive and interfering with their lives. And the programs, the 400 programs in China, they're all abstinence-based, and they use beating, and they use electric shocks, and there were reports of at least one death. And, of course, this is kind of outrageous and immoral and inhumane, and they're trying to change it. Singapore has a fantastic model of, I was lecturing there last year on this topic, of cyber wellness, and actually my daughter and I may go there in December this year again to lecture there. So they're very enlightened, and what they're really teaching young kids is a balance between online and offline from very young age. So they introduce computers into the educational system from the government, a directed kind of programs very early on, but at the same time they teach them about issues of pornography and stalking and all these things online, as well as how to get offline, online, to move in and out. And we don't have this kind of programs yet in the United States. Some of the internet addicted online, there's some programs which kind of make a lot of people laughed a lot of good cartoons about kind of internet addicted people doing 12 step or online, you know. And so it's funny, but actually there's a lot of merit for them if they learn how to do the harm reduction. So we need to kind of be thoughtful, not to move to an abstinence model while they do need computer in order to function as a full citizen in this world.
Well, we're getting some comments in here that says they'd really like to hear us talk about that digital ethics. So I know you and I have talked about it. We're going to make sure we do that sometime soon.
Okay, yeah, this is really cutting edge. But I do have a lot of material
on
that online. I have blogs online. You can put your 2 cents. And the blogs are actually interesting because people just bring different perspective, which is show how rich and diverse it is. What I don't like is the people get all huffy about their position rather than being thoughtful about their position. But it's the nature of our profession, a lot of huffiness.
Well, we haven't always been known for our flexibility, let's put it that way.
No, we sure haven't.
Although there are over 400 theories of therapy, so maybe we are more flexible than I thought.
Yeah.
Listen, Ofer, it's been a sheer delight talking with you today. You bring such an interesting and entertaining perspective, and you're always one step ahead of the average bear. So I just really, really want to thank you for your thought leadership in this area, for being a personal mentor for me for many years, and just for this conversation today. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Casey. It's so nice always for you kind of to lead conversation. You know, I can always relax into the interview because I know you'll carry it beautifully.
Well, a lot of people have said that these talks are kind of like fireside chats, and that's what I enjoy about them, too. So thank you, everybody.
Too.
Thank you, Ofer, and we'll look forward to seeing you on other calls. Take care. Good
thank
night.
Thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Good night.